Welcome to Coaching Uncaged, the podcast that pushes the boundaries of the coaching profession with cutting-edge practitioners, authors, and thought leaders. Coaching Uncaged brings you pioneering thinking to enrich the art and science of coaching in all its forms. And now, introducing your host, Robert Stevenson.
Welcome to this episode of Coaching Uncaged. Today, I am excited to be speaking with Linda Page. Linda is the founder of the Adler Graduate Professional School. Linda is a psychotherapist, a coach, a Buddhist, an author, a teacher, a mentor, and so much more. And today, we're going to be spending some time sort of exploring Linda's journey, her reflections on coaching's kind of foundations and where it's landing right now, perhaps a look at where it might go in the future. But to start with, Linda, why don't you introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about Adler?
I'd love to do that. And thank you so much. I feel so honored and privileged to be here with you, Robert. I got interested in Adlerian psychology because this is after I had studied, psychology, anthropology, sociology, and I wanted to do something with that, not just to research it and find out all the things that didn't work, because I was trained as a social science researcher, and that's what my PhD is in. Mm. And it was so unsatisfying to just find out all the thinking and the what ifs, and but not something that actually works. So I was introduced to Adlerian psychology in I think 1978 or so, and I found that, and actually I was introduced to it in a parenting class, and I changed my attitude towards my kids because of that, and they became much more cooperative. And so I thought, wow, this works. This is worth teaching. So I studied Adlerian psychology and became a psychotherapist, and then decided, gee, if I can help a lot of people become psychotherapists, then there'll be a lot more people who help. And so I started teaching, and eventually we had the opportunity here in Ontario to start a graduate school and to teach psychotherapy. We have a master's degree in psychology, and we also started coaching. And I have found the basic underpinnings of coaching to be very, very similar to what I learned as assumptions in Adlerian psychology. In fact, when we started our coaching program in 1998, we gathered together people who had been certified as coaches, and most of them knew very little about Adler. But as I explained to them the assumptions underlying Adlerian psychology or psychotherapy, the application of Adlerian psychology, they said, "Oh my goodness, that sounds so much like coaching." Alfred Adler must be a grandfather of coaching. And I think just the study of coaching history that Vicki Brock did, I think shows that, you know, Adlerian ideas were influenced people from way back. And those ideas then, you were talking about my own journey. So I'll just say how I came up. That what happened was I was invited to work with David Rock on the book called Coaching with the Brain in Mind. So I was invited to work on this book with David. And we decided that we needed to do a couple of things, which one of which is to look at the foundations of coaching.
Yeah.
And so, and he also, of course, we both were very interested in neuroscience. So he kind of specialized in the, how do you apply neuroscience to coaching? We both talked about it and everything and helped each other, but that was kind of his part of the book. And I worked on the foundations part. And what I and we were seeking answers to questions that Julio Olaya came up with, which were, you know, why did coaching come about now at the end of the 20th century? Why, you know, are people taking it up with such fervor, really? And when I looked over the history of coaching and the history of the 20th century, I realized that the 20th century was a time when science went from a mechanistic approach. You know, you take apart, you look at things and figure out what makes up the things and figure out, then once you understand what makes up the things, then you understand everything. But a systemic approach says you can't really understand the things unless you look at their relationships with other things. And that's kind of a central aspect of systems thinking. So I thought, wow, coaching, if you look at the assumptions of coaching, resourceful, creative, and whole, that requires a more systems approach than a mechanistic one. It's not Taylorism. It's not scientific measurement, management. It's how you have to look at relationships. You know, in fact, you might say that 20th century physics' most important discovery was that relationships are more important than things. So relationships between us and within us and all, that is how we help people in coaching. We help them understand who they are and what they want out of life. And I realized, wait a minute, back when Adler started developing his theory, he started out as a colleague of Freud's, and then they parted ways. And if you look at it, it's partly because Adler maintained that systemic approach that had came, you know, from past philosophy. And whereas Freud was much more interested in establishing of psychoanalysis as a scientific theory, but science of that time, Adler actually had an approach that was much more like science of this time, because we know that even though the smallest elements in the universe are you only see them. Or let me say, if you change your relationship with anything, it changes how you see it. And that is certainly true of, you know, quantum mechanics, for instance. And so I guess that was my answer to the question of why coaching, why now, and why is it so similar to Adler? Because of systems thinking. So let me just get back to us. Oh, I'm gonna stop share. Okay, sorry. So that was that's the book that we wrote, and I explained that there anyway. So that I think that gives you a little that answered your question. Tell me about Adler. Well, Adler was a guy who practiced psychotherapy in a way that is, I believe, if he were alive today, he'd be a coach. No question in my mind about that. And he practiced psychotherapy in a way that was not considered scientific at the time. And many of his theories were rejected because that, oh, you're talking about values? That's not scientific, right? He persisted, thank goodness, so that we are now able to enjoy the development of a more systemic approach. And now many other psychotherapists, I teach a course in the evolution of psychotherapy, and most other psychotherapies are moving towards that systemic approach, not because they're copying Adler, because most people don't know enough about Adler to copy him, but anyway, because the understanding of how to understand has changed over the past century.
So one thought here is how ahead of his time he was, or his thinking was, and this idea that lots of other ways of working are just catching up now in terms of understanding that it's about systems and things, relationship to other things, our relationships to others that sort of equate the quality of change or the ability to change, as well as understanding ourselves. We understand ourselves in relation to others.
Yes. And
so there's something really interesting there about how, you know, that he was so far ahead of his time and how it's taken a while for it to uncover. And at the same time, there's something, I guess, quite sad about the fact that not many people would recognize Adler as one of the forefathers of coaching.
Yeah, well, that's the curse of the pioneer, in a sense. You know, they go out and they, you know, till the ground and all that, and then everybody else comes along and says, "Oh, let's put a farm here."
Yeah, I guess so. And yeah. and often, I guess, with these sorts of things, that it's cyclical, so it comes back round, and people then rediscover his work. And are able to go, oh, okay, so this work is a grounding in what we currently do without having recognized it before. Because when I think about systems thinking, I don't necessarily think about Adler. But when I was doing some of my research around it, I was kind of going, oh, okay, you know, he's talking about that tension between our being ourselves and being in relation to others, and how we wrestle with that tension. And sometimes coaching is the space that we sit in to explore that wrestle that we have.
That's right. And in particular, I think the wrestle of that paradox. Here I am. Nobody else will ever know the world as I see it. I am unique, and everything in this world, it kind of feels like it's laid out here for me to enjoy. And yet, I cannot survive unless I recognize that the other people around me see things the same way. They're the center of their universe. Now, how can we make these centers collaborate? And I always like the word collaborate, work together, co-labor. Mm-hmm. How do we make these centers intersect so that we all can be our full unique selves? Because really, as long as any of one of us is not permitted to explore who we really are, then by one of the kind of rules of Adlerian psychology, we're all under the threat of that. I mean, if it's not for all of us, if it's not for this one, then it's not for all.
So right? there's something interesting there about, you know, what drives us to be coaches. And it makes me wonder, is there an underlying unconscious recognition that in order for us all as a community to do well, people need the space to be at their best. And therefore, my role is to enable others to be at their best. Because I often find that coaches have been coaching for a lot of their lives before they've found what coaching actually is.
Exactly,
they've been playing that role or that part. And it just makes me wonder if there is some kind of system within humanity that says we all need to pull together to make this work.
Well, what Adler said was that the healthy resolution of that paradox is not me versus others, but me and others, right?
Mm.
And so he called that social interest. That when we see that our best interests are actually not in competition with everyone else's. I mean, you can operate as if that's true. But at the base, if we see other people as being there on the same basis that we are there because we want to, you know, live, when we see that our interests are bound up with their best interests and we operate in such a way as to make us both be able to grow and develop, then that is what bodes well for an individual's mental health. And I would argue for family, society, businesses, you know, the world, human species, to be healthier. So that was one of the reasons that people originally rejected Adler's view, because he said, you know, it was a very positive view. In that sense, he was one of the first positive psychologists. But he said that, you know, believing in yourself and others is the key to being to health, to well-being. And he called that social interest.
As you were saying that, it reminded me of Carl Rogers' idea of holding people in positive regard.
Absolutely.
And that notion of when we do that, we enable something to take place even without any action, but just by holding that space in that way.
Yeah, it's kind of like you clear a space in the garden, and you don't have to go down there and push the roots up, you know. That's what life is. It grows, and it tends to grow toward the light unless in some way it's been mistreated.
And so, you know, when we were talking before, and you spoke about these different strands of who you are, and how they come together. So, you know, we're talking here about the psychotherapist and the coach, but there's also these other strands, the Buddhist being one of them.
One of the reasons I joined the Buddhist practice that I belong to was the Soka Gakkai. Nichiren Buddhism comes out of Japan. And I joined in 1973. And in 1978, discovered Adlerian a psychotherapy, and I thought, oh, this really fits. and in a sense, we were talking about how, you know, Adler's systemic approach was kind of, you know, he was a leader in that and, way ahead of his time and all that. In a sense, if you look at indigenous traditions and Buddhism around the world, the idea that we are, that we are all connected, that is absolutely nothing new. The idea that if one person in a community is sick, it's the whole community's privilege, really, to respond and help. And those kinds of ideas are rooted in spiritual and religious practice and indigenous traditions around the world. So it's just, I think somehow or other, for some reason, and part of the reason I think that Adler hung on to those traditions was that he was very much influenced by a Marxism, which, if you know, at the end of the 19th century was, you know, basically pitted democracy or self-determination against authoritarianism. And he was very much on the side of self-determination. Mm. Now, you know, there's a lot happened in Marxism since that time. So the concepts of socialism have kind of been covered over by, imperialist wars and that kind of thing. And by the great betrayal, in my mind, the great betrayal of socialism that happened with Stalin. But anyway, if you go back to that, the basics, Marx was a systemic thinker. That's how he was able to see the relationship between workers and bosses. And see that it's the relationship that is the key to understanding society from Marx's view. And I think Adler was very influenced by that. In fact, Adler's wife, Raisa, was from Russia, and she was a very brilliant woman, but of course she couldn't go to medical school as a woman at that time. But anyway, she was quite brilliant. And he really just fell head over heels in love with her. And she was best friends with Leon Trotsky's wife. So, you know, the strand of Marxism continued through. And I don't know, you know, one of the things that caused that, a simple way in my mind that I say caused the breakup between Freud and Adler is around what Freud called penis envy. And Adler, and I know that this was influenced by his feminist wife, said, no, I don't think it's the penis women envy, it's their power. And so in a sense, it's, you know, it's a more a cognitive and systemic view than a biological and reductionist view. And that, and Adler wasn't willing to give up that systemic view. And then, so they parted ways in 1911. But anyway, a little history there. But that just, you know, goes to your point of the, of that. There is something about life that seeks to make it better. I mean, in a sense, that's what we're here for. To, you know, we are given so much. This world is an incredible place, and it, golly gee, it supports human life so far. wow, is that wonderful? And I think it's a part of life that when you give, it gives back, you know? And I think that's what coaches are. They're, we recognize that. That great privilege of having something to contribute. And I was just thinking today, you know, that I just making my bed. And I was thinking, I really like to have a nice bed that looks great. I walk in the bedroom, it looks really nice. I love that. I thought, that's that feeling of contribution. It's like when one of our clients says, oh, you mean I can say what I want? That's okay. Yes, I give you permission right now, boy. And it's like this light lit, and you go out of there feeling, whoa, you know, this is why I'm here. And I think it's seeking that we're after in coaching. Do you make sense?
Yeah. So I completely get that and agree that there is this, the desire as a coach to facilitate or enable our clients finding or giving themselves that permission to be themselves and to do what they want to do, how they choose to do it. And as you were saying that, it made me wonder about when that desire becomes the driving force, the desire to do good, or to be recognized as doing good, whether that's by a client or whether that's by society, and then how that might overshadow the quality of the work or the frequency of the work, because it becomes about us and not the system.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, and of course, looking at Buddhism, we say that we have that potential for wanting everybody to, and Buddhism, we say, have the body of a Buddha, that is to be able to behave in that way. And so if that's the case, then it's not surprising to also say that we all also have the potential to be greedy and angry and seek revenge and all that, you know, fundamental darkness, which, you know, religions recognize in all different ways. And that's there. And that is really the choice that we make daily. We look at ourselves and ask ourselves, is this the expression of my my best potential. And in that process of reflection, then we, in a sense, you might say we do battle with that, those other tendencies that are all too ready to jump out. And those, though in Buddhism, we say those lower, quote, lower, those more darker tendencies or less positive tendencies, that would be a better word, less positive tendencies are, they're there all the time. And you can look at them, you have a choice, you can look at them as, oh, every time I do battle and don't give up, because after all, if we never give up, we're never defeated. Of course, you know, there's some people that I would rather would admit defeat. But hey, that we get stronger. It's just like in working out. We get stronger. And that in a sense, if we look at all those obstacles to our being the best that we can be, and we recognize them, face them, overcome them, we get stronger. And that helps to build. It's practice for those crucial times when we need to draw not on what our immediate reaction is, but on what we know is better, to ask ourselves, what's the difference that's going to make the difference, a good difference in this situation? So, well, that's the process of spiritual practice as I see it.
Yeah, and it sort of it's that reflection of the self, and I guess in coaching we are reflecting the client's self back to them so they can see themselves through a lens that is less filtered, I guess, because we all have our filters and our biases are at play, but a less filtered lens, and in that reflection we can make choices about, well, how do we want to show up. And which of those battles with those less positive side of the selves do we want to fight? Because at the same time, there's a part of me that sort of says that those other sides of us also make us. So they can't be ignored or disregarded. They are part of the system. So they have to be, I guess, welcomed in. Otherwise, they become our shadow, our dark side that we try and battle and hide away from the world.
Right, right. So it's like systems move towards goals, and usually complex systems operate on very simple goals, generally. Like, you know, for instance, capitalism operates on the goal of accumulate. Marx said, that is the Moses and the prophets in capitalism, accumulate and computer die. Those two rules kind of guide the system of capitalism. And if we then can formulate different rules for guiding ourselves and society, like, you know, what is best for all, then we would all, well, children would grow up learning very differently. This slide kind of brings all together the strands, because I've kind of, for many years, I was a practicing Buddhist. I was teaching coaching and psychotherapy. And I was involved with my partner, Susan Rosenthal, in writing or in thinking through what socialism would look like in today's world, and trying to remove the accretions of the past century. And so in 2016, when Trump was elected, and I don't mean to be, well, I do mean to be political. What am I saying? When Trump was elected, we at Adler said, whoa, wait a minute. We want to take a stand. This is important right now. We need to say where we're at. So the whole community came together and came up with this community declaration. So basically, recent world events have revealed a conflict between the belief that everyone is equally worthy and all, that only some are worthy and the rest are disposable. We at Adler support the right of everyone to live free of oppression and deprivation. What we want for ourselves, we want for all.
So in there, as you talk about wanting good for all, and also this idea of wanting to be political, it made me think about, you know, coaching is a political space.
Exactly.
And it may not be political as we see it as political parties, let's say, but there are concepts or ideas or ideals that sit within coaching that lend themselves to that political lens.
That's true.
And I think part of what I'm noticing, what has been very evident in the work that we've been doing at Animus recently, has been leaning into some of that around... Yes. You know, Black Lives Matter, inclusion, diversity, having conversations around these topics and asking the question of where does coaching sit within this and where is coaching affected by this and what's the effect that coaching can make or a coaching organization can make in these fields, recognizing on one hand that this is about humanity. You know, how can we live well as humans, as a collective, but also there is this politicalness to it that we don't always associate with coaching.
Yeah, somehow we think of coaching as being outside that. Pauline Gelchon and Dima Louise wrote this book called Complex Situations in Coaching.
Okay.
And they asked me to do respond to a case where this coach named Martin was being asked to coach a mining company that was exploiting someplace in Latin America. And so he was wondering, do I do that and help them exploit better? Or, you know, or do I refuse the job? And he finally decided, no, he better take it, because if he refuses that, then he wouldn't have any coaching jobs. What I say in my comment on that, I say that we are all coaches and corporate executives and employees and customers around the world. We are one species with 1,000 times more similarities than differences. We are each born into circumstances that we didn't choose to be born into. Some of us who were born into more privileged circumstances choose to think that this accidental fact makes us more deserving as people. Mm-hmm. And that conflict is what we talked about, is that this belief that everyone deserves whatever their differences, everyone deserves to be considered worthy. So basically, coaching respects the client's perspective, listening to their story, encouraging them to explore their own meaning, acknowledges their strengths, believes in their capacity to change, supports their actions, and thereby enacts a value of appreciating each and every human being. So in that sense, we are enacting that value when we treat this person in front of us as a person fully deserving of every, you know, everything we can, all the support we can give them.
Hmm.
Now, that, of course, I think there the conflict exists in the world where there are organizations and even whole countries that have decided it's in their best interest to impose their will on others and deny the others, self-determination. And so as coaches, shouldn't we be talking about that dilemma? Do we use our capacity to expand other people's capacity so that they can better exploit us? is that how we want to use coaching? And I think that's something that we should definitely be discussing. What is the role of coaching in the world? One of the mechanistic mistakes of psychology is to treat people as individuals, as supreme. All considerations start and stop with the individual. And that, of course, goes against the idea of the extent to which we are all related. And if you, just like with a spider's web, you pull one little, we're interrelated, you pull one part of the spider's web, and the spider feels it, even if she's way off in the corner, right? So in our web of relationships as a human species, somebody twinges over in, Burundi. And, you know, even though we may not notice it right away, a cause like that is going to have an effect eventually.
I think this is one of those complex conversations. There isn't a simple answer to this, because I think part of what makes it complex or difficult is that we sometimes don't feel those ripples in a conscious way. So we don't notice it. So we don't respond or react to it, because we're not picking up that spider web shake, because we're so far away from the epicenter of the shake. Yeah. We're not noticing it. So we go,
that hasn't reached us yet.
So we're not responding. And also there is this, I guess, this idea of, well, who are we to respond? Who are we to take up that battle?
Yes.
And as I say that, I also recognize that there are things that are changing. So I notice within our own organization, we have championed social impact and this idea of how do we as a collective support social change or social action or social support, and really recognizing how, especially during the pandemic, that idea that you spoke about before of the collective wanting to support and do good or be of service, rather, how during the beginnings of the pandemic, the community was self-creating these mechanisms to do good. And as an organization, we went, well, how can we harness that good to lead into the world? So whilst we on one level would not call ourselves a political organization, somebody on the outside might look at us and go, but that is that is part of politics. We might not say it's this party or that party politics, but there is a politicalness to the work that we do, which then creates this idea of what's the choice of those interactions that we want to have. Is it that we want to be part of something that's saving the world, saving the environment, or do we want to be something that's supporting teachers or supporting people that are out of work or young people? But all of those different sort of supports have a politicalness to them, but we might not necessarily name them as such.
Yeah, I think that politicalness is... It permeates everything, and it's similar to the pandemic. There's a vaccine in one place and not in another, and that kind of disparity. And so I agree. Our organization as a school also is saying, okay, how can we intervene in this terrible, tragic sadness? And what you need to intervene is power. And ultimately, when I studied political sociology, the definition of politics was it's about power, right? But most people think of it as it's about a party.
Yeah.
Or a partisan. And so, in fact, we do have to have the power to make a difference. And what kind of power is at our disposal? You guys, for Coaching Uncaged, you're doing these interviews with, you know, it's really, I look down the list of the interviews, just fabulous. And you are using your power to do that. Now, what we are doing at our school is we're totally revising. We hired a provost who has authority over both the academic side and the administrative side. And her job is to develop inclusion, anything that we can do to support inclusion and social justice. And so we're revising our whole curriculum to include, to weave those questions into every interaction that we have. Not just that, oh, we're going to give you a little course on here and you forget it, you know, but rather everything we do, we're examining it from that perspective. And I know that that's happening for coaches right around the world and coaching organizations.
Yeah. And it's one of the things that I find interesting about this idea of looking at language and concepts that promote inclusion is that sometimes they're already there, but we haven't uncovered them and given them enough air or enough voice or enough energy to fully exist and stand out in the space. And one of the things that we're looking at is, where are we already doing this, but just not doing it loud enough, strong enough, or focused enough?
That's very good. That's a very good way to ask the question, isn't it? Yes. So have you found any of those places?
Well, yeah, we have. I mean, so in terms of the organizational structure, when we think about inclusion, we look at it and we go, well, we're pretty inclusive. We're a pretty inclusive school. And you look at the various cultures that are part of the faculty or the administration, you go, wow, okay. But then you notice that there are these little areas where we go, oh, but we don't have that in our space. Now, is that because somebody of that kind or type has not chosen to come and be with us, or have we not looked for that?
Right.
So how can we then dial up what we're looking for?
Right.
And what we're asking for, so that if somebody chooses to, they can come and be part of our community.
That's yes, I recognize that. We and this provost, you know, is she points out she comes from an Islamic background and as a person of color, and she will say sometimes to me, oh, you know, that was a bit offensive. And I realize that one of the things I would like to see permeate our whole school is the idea that I rely on you to point those things out because I don't see them and I want to. And, you know, I grew up in a segregated, city in Texas. And so I know that my own experience personally, I notice when people are Black. However, when I went to college, I had like a big sister a year ahead of me who, you know, kind of was my mentor and showed me around and everything. And about 6 months after I started school, and her name was Deanna. And one of my friends said, oh, yeah, well, Deanna, you know, she's Japanese. And I said, you're kidding, really? I had spent all that time with her and never noticed. And I thought, oh, that's that unconscious prejudice that I learned in one situation, segregated. Racial segregation, and another situation where was it a different matter. And I know she experienced, some bias, but in this school, I hadn't noticed that. And it took someone else to point that out to me. So my attitude now, and one I hope we all at our school can do is, I don't want to say to people who have a different background from me, tell me about your, I mean, it's not anyone else's job to educate me, but I really appreciate when people notice things that I don't notice, and I want to make sure that I appreciate them for doing that. And because I think there's a bit of a tendency to be defensive. Wait a minute, I'm not racist. Oh my God, not me. You know, and I want us, if we're really going to work together, then I think people respect those different perspectives, because some of those perspectives make a life or death difference.
So something that I saw Simon Sinek talking about the other day was this idea of perspective, and that what inclusion creates is these multiple perspectives from which we can see things, and how greater we can be when we have those perspectives in the space. And the other thought here as well is that how do we see the individual for who they are, and not just their culture, their creed, their sexuality,
but that
person that's in that space. So I think sometimes within this work, we can get a little caught up in, I need to know everything about your culture. And that can be interesting and that can be useful. But as a coach, I want to know everything about you that's relevant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm with you on that. Absolutely. And of course, one of the Adlerian principles is that everybody is unique. And that's also a coaching principle. Mm. There isn't anybody. And I did a study one time of people that I consider master therapists. And I know this applies for coaches also. The question that I asked them was, okay, you have a new client coming to your door, and you walk up to your door and you start to open it to meet this new person you've never met before. What goes through your mind at that moment? I was quite surprised to find a great similarity there. People, the master therapist said, one guy used a metaphor. He said, I'm about to open an incredible pantry that has every possible spice you can imagine. And there's going to be a bunch there that I've never tried. Yay. Mm-hmm. I can't wait. Another one said, you know, there's the person on the other side of this door is like unlike anyone I will ever meet again. The way that I thought of that was that, or the label that I put on that attitude is curiosity, but yeah, respectful curiosity, yeah, appreciative curiosity. And I thought, yeah, that marks our immediate approach to this other specimen. And then of course we want to find out all the stuff that, you know, makes them who they are, if it's relevant. And yes, of course that's part of the curiosity. Ooh, how did you? Ooh, oh, you're so beautiful. How did you get to be like that? Oh my goodness! And celebrate that. That's the attitude I'm hoping we'll all have as much as possible.
And do you think that that attitude is something that we have to cultivate? I'm not sure if that's the right question. Yes. Let me leave that question there. Yeah.
Well, yes. And you know where it starts? In our mirror.
The self.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You look at, and in Buddhism, we say, you bow to your mirror and the mirror bows back. So if you can learn to bow to your mirror in such a way that you offer yourself the same, what can I say, respect, love, consideration, hope, all the good things that you that you would offer in a second to any client that walked through your door.
And this just
that's how we learn.
And that makes me think about this idea of doing the work ourselves. Not becoming the savior of others, but also becoming the savior of ourselves. How do we do that work ourselves? How do we do our practice, as you said earlier, that how do we do that reflection on the self as well as others? Because I think when we forget to do the work on ourselves, that's where this idea of we do good,
yeah,
and we're important starts to creep in.
Yeah.
Because we're not in that, I don't know if you'd call it humble or graceful space of I'm doing this, I'm walking the walk, talking the talk, as well as working with my coachees to do that work as well.
Yeah. And then I think together we are a two-person system, and then that spreads out, and maybe there'll be more and more and more bigger systems. Yeah, about doing that work on yourself. I wrote a little poem that says, you know, it's about coaches giving advice, you know, you can tell me, but you can't sell me on the rules for living and loving. Even if you've read every book on every shelf, you can school me, golden rule me, but there's no need pushing and shoving, because I can only take that medicine for myself.
That's
so
beautiful.
All the good words, the good words that we can think of. That's all could be medicine, but we start with ourselves. I agree.
That feels like a lovely space to conclude this chapter of our conversation, Linda. It's been an absolute pleasure sharing the space with you today. Thank you so much for being in the space with me.
Oh, thank you, and thank the whole Animus organization for doing the work you're doing.
Thank you. I will do. Thank you so much.
If you'd like to watch these episodes as well as listen, you can find the video interviews on our YouTube channel and website now. Thanks for tuning in to Coaching Uncaged. Join us again for more captivating conversations, exploring the art of coaching.